Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the John DeNugent Show, blogtalkradio.com, hosted by eNationalist.com. This is your host, John DeNugent, from the mighty and beautiful Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in the heart of the angry working-class white Rust Belt. This is an area of four states, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Kentucky, and Ohio, where white people have been suffering for many decades through the federal government closing down the wonderful jobs we used to have in the steel mills and the coal mines and the glass factories and the aluminum factories, such as Alcoa and United States Steel. At one point, all we had left in Pittsburgh was Heinz ketchup. But I tell you what, this city has come back. We have a wonderful ethnic collection here of people. We have a lot of Germans and Slovaks and Poles and Irish and Scotch-Irish. And we've got some fighters here. And I just had a wonderful encounter. Went out to a nice little bar, restaurant, pool hall last night. A comrade drove over 3 hours to visit with me and with Henry Kalapa. And this comrade said, "Hey, let's play some pool." And we were playing pool. And two gentlemen, it's like they wanted to talk with me. And it turned out two nice gentlemen in their 40s, beautifully trimmed beards, excellent Northern European appearance. And boy, they were ready. They were ready to talk about white civil rights and taking back our country. And frankly, Barack Hussein Obama has scared these people. And they're looking for leadership, looking for the man, they're looking for the plan. And so I'm very encouraged by the reaction I'm getting everywhere, not just here in western Pennsylvania, but throughout the state of Pennsylvania, in neighboring Ohio, down in Kentucky, which my fiance Margaret and I drove through and talked with many wonderful and angry, wonderfully angry people in Kentucky. We were over in Cincinnati, Ohio, after that, and West Virginia, saying this is a four-state region that could become a bastion of white civil rights, right survival, and power for white people to lead lives of dignity and safety. If you have not been to my website lately, we had a very eventful participation at David Duke's Euro website. David Duke's organization is the European European American Unity and Rights Organization, EURO. And if you go to davidduke.com, scroll down right down to the front page, you'll see my big article about the show and a pod blank of me on television on ABC 24 in Memphis, and then Margaret Huffstickler singing a beautiful song by Stephen Foster of Pittsburgh, and also Henry Kalapa speaking superbly, in fact, and my speech, which also received some encouraging praise from those who drove hundreds of miles or flew thousands of miles to attend David Duke's conference in Tennessee, which, despite the fact that we were chased out of hotel after hotel and police and hostility, and Dr. David Duke, PhD in history, he was ejected from his hotel room by the manager and two cops. Outrageous, outrageous violations of the First Amendment and of free speech. And of our neighboring DeSoto County, Mississippi, passed a no-gathering ordinance saying no groups allowed to have gatherings in DeSoto County. Unbelievable. It's a rape of the Constitution of the United States. And needless to say, this is just to harass Duke until it was over. Clearly something like that cannot stand because the First Amendment is sacred, guaranteeing us the right of absolute freedom of speech and the right to meet peacefully and discuss our grievances and our opinions. And God bless America, we also have nearly absolute freedom to have guns, even machine guns, if you pay a license for it. And the purpose of guns, it's not to hunt ducks, it's not to shoot a burglar. The main purpose, as Thomas Jefferson said, and Abraham Lincoln reiterated this, I don't like everything about Abraham Lincoln, the people have the right to overthrow a tyrannical government that if it morphs into a monster, which is taking away our freedoms and our dignity and our ability to survive. And now with Barack Hussein Obama approaching power, white people need to organize, recognize that we are a minority in this world, a small minority, perhaps 7% of the world's population. And we are becoming also a minority within the United States. The latest information indicates whites are now a minority of the children under age 8. It's full of blacks and Hispanics and Asians and whatnot. And we are becoming a minority of the women of childbearing years. And that's the only two statistics that count, because that talks about the future of our race. White women in their 60s and 70s are not going to be having children to bail out the white race. That's over. We need to rebuild the white family. We need strong, responsible white males to be good husbands and fathers and providers. We need women who are revered and honored as mothers and wives and cooks, and for the beauty and the kindness that women create and spread in this rough and tumble world, which for better or for worse is male dominated. But boy, we certainly need to respect our women, and especially our mothers, and those who bring art and poetry and gentleness and happiness to children when they're growing up. So we have our work cut out for us. I had a delightful surprise now that I'm coming to talk about our guest today. Delightful surprise, a friend named Sid from Washington, D.C., said that a Steve Godfrey from Australia was going to speak at the Council of Conservative Citizens in Washington, D.C., and there was a successful meeting there. Steve is from way down the other side of the globe in Australia, in Oz, and from Queensland in the northern tropical part of Australia. We think of Australia as the dry outback and sort of a parched country with a little bit of water here and there and kangaroos hopping about. But that's not northern Australia. It's next to Indonesia. It's next to the jungles. And Steve was telling me as we were preparing our talk, if you just sit up in bed, you'll be bathed in sweat in the summertime. Which, by the way, their summertime is December and January, because the seasons are flipped down there on the other side of the world. And I think Steve actually confirmed to me something I always wanted to know, that it is true that when you flush a toilet, the water actually spins in the opposite direction. Well, Steve is on the phone right now. He's actually visiting our home here in Sarver, Pennsylvania, north of Pittsburgh. So, Steve Godfrey, welcome to the John DeNugent Show.
Thank you for having me as your guest, John.
Well, it's a great honor. I was telling you, Steve, as we walked through the night and saw the gorgeous nighttime skyline of Pittsburgh, that he's lucky because, and we're lucky to have him, but he's lucky because the two favorite peoples, foreign peoples that Americans like, they love the Irish and they love the Australians. So you are very, very welcome in our country, and because you are a white man, you are welcome in any white country on earth, and you are fighting for white Australia. So we're eager to have you tell us a little bit about that. Just give us a little resume of what you're doing, and then afterwards we're going to take a little break, and we're going to play the most famous song in Australia called Waltzing Matilda. So tell us a little bit about yourself, Steve.
Okay. Well, I'm age 48. I'm married with a wife and three children. We've been active in politics, the whole family, since a very early age. I began my political career at age 15. We had a left-wing tyrant in there called Whitlam. We've got two alternative political parties. There's the AOP and the Liberal National Party Alliance, and they take turns. It's a duopoly. Regardless of which party is in power, the same policies are pursued. I think you have the similar problem here.
You certainly do. The Republicans and Democrats both want amnesty for illegal aliens, both want to continue the war in Iraq, no matter what Barack Hussein abomination claims. He will continue whatever wars Israel wants, as white boys die, to defend the Israeli domination of the Middle East and the Israeli attempt to get their mitts on the oil of the Middle East and the oil of Iraq. So we have no freedom of choice, which is why we desperately need a new third political party, perhaps to be called the Democratic Republicans. We had five presidential elections won by the Democratic Republicans. The first Democratic Republican was some guy named Thomas Jefferson. And he was a good little scribe, but he wrote a piece of paper called The Declaration of Independence. And he also was very involved with the Constitution, governor of Virginia, and two-term president of the United States. A real down-to-earth man, a Scottish ancestry, a good Celt. Now, you're Australians have a lot of Celtic ancestry, don't they?
Yes, we do.
Mm-hmm. So what's your background? Irish, Scottish,
well,
Welsh?
Three quarters Irish and one quarter Welsh. But I can explain that.
Well, let me tell you, I have a friend named Stan Hess, and he said, "Let me read you something," and it was about how the Jews built Hollywood, and some guy was gloating about it, and it was funny because there's an anecdote in there where Harry Cohn was a big Hollywood Jewish producer, but he had very little use for the Jews, actually. He was very critical of Jewish power. So anyway, some Jewish charity called him and said, "We want you to make a donation for all the Jewish victims over in Europe or somewhere." And he says, the Jewish victims, he said, "Jews and Irishmen have called all the world's troubles." Now, I can say that because my last name is Nugent. But the Irish really have a history of rebellions. You had a great rebellion against the power of the British plutocrats, I guess, called the Eureka Rebellion.
Yes,
which
is true.
Described in the magazine I write a lot for, the Barnes Review. Tell us a little bit about that, because that was a proud moment in Australian history.
Well,
1834, was it?
If you go back, I think I was saying it last night, the history of America and Australia are interrelated, and where you brought free settlers to America and religious people, they were not allowed into Australia. When America broke away from Britain, the British had to think, and they thought, okay, we won't allow free settlers in Australia, we'll only bring convicts over. And a lot of those convicts were Irish. 160,000 whites were brought to Australia, and as Irish, they were survivors of the perpetual revolts that are going on there. And 1854 was our most famous revolt, and that was led by an Irishman called Peter Lola. But 50 years before, there was a minor revolt called the Vinegar Hill Revolt, and that was led by...
Did you say vinegar, as in oil and vinegar?
Yeah, Vinegar Hill, outside Parramatta, near Sydney. And that was led by the survivors of the 1798 Wolfetone Revolt in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
The British transported every single one of them to Australia, and then they had the generals who'd led the Irish Republican Army and others, and they let them loose as slaves, didn't realize they instantly began organizing. So, well, the British soon solved that problem.
Well, see, that proves what Harry Cohn said, the Irish caused all the troubles in the world.
But not much is known about the 1804 revolt, because the British solved it in the usual way. They executed everybody.
Oh.
So there were no survivors of that revolt. 1854, they stormed the Eureka. They built themselves a stockade. And a lot of the miners who were supported Peter Lola were actually American 49ers who'd come over from California. They noticed a similar terrain, and they were instrumental in discovering gold in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing they wouldn't put up with was oppressive British laws.
Mm-hmm.
And they carried out an uprising the year before, 1853.
So you're saying many of the ringleaders were Americans?
Yes, that's right.
Literally Americans. And because, you know, we were very proud that 50 years before all this, we had revolted successfully against the British Empire.
Exactly.
And so these white Americans were helping their white Australian brothers.
That's right.
To also rebel against, not, I mean, my grandfather's from England, and the English common people can be fantastic and brave and honest, but boy, you've got a plutocracy, a rule by billionaires, many of whom hooked in with the Rothschild-dominated Bank of England, and they are ruthless, and they have no use for any white people on earth. And so you've got the English ruling class versus the English common people, and everybody's a victim of the British ruling class.
Hmm. Well, the beauty of the goldfields in the 1850s was people could come from anywhere, and they had reports that whole ship's crews would dock in Sydney, and they'd all run away. And they'd run to the goldfields because at that stage you could literally pick gold up off the ground.
Hmm.
Anybody could just go and make themselves some money.
So you also is just gold diggers, that's what you are.
Well, the interesting thing is a lot of the ship's crews were Americans,
uh-huh.
and a lot of them were Irish, and that's how they got to the goldfields. And when they arrived, they thought, okay, we'll have freedom, but they found that the British government was there before them.
Yeah.
And they stood up for their rights, and there were 1,500 of them in the stockade, and the British attacked just before dawn one morning on the 3rd of December, 1854, while the miners were asleep, and they massacred them. And they executed 29 miners on the spot, and they put the rest on trial for sedition. Hundreds of men on trial for sedition. Now, it caused a controversy because it was suddenly revealed that so many of them were Americans.
Controversy. By the way, you know, there's just a little differences in pronunciation. In America, we would say controversy.
Ah,
controversy.
Sorry. I'm learning.
Yeah, like in, it's the British English versus North American. Oh. Like, for example, you say laboratory, right?
Yes.
And we say laboratory.
Ah, okay.
So England and Australia are two great nations divided by a common language.
So when they went on trial, it turned out that the American consul demanded immunity for these Americans. So, okay, they got let free. And then the Polish consul did the same thing, and it turned out there were 34 different nationalities, until finally there were very few to go on trial, so the judge just squashed the whole thing.
Oh, that's good.
And Peter Lola, who was the Irishman who led the revolt, even though he almost was killed at the spot, he later became a member of Parliament.
Oh.
And that's one of those strange things about Australian history. If you stand up to the system, sometimes they embrace you.
That's interesting. Well, people will always respect a man, unless you're a complete psychopath without any honor at all. Well, I said to our listeners that I'd like to play the song Waltzing Matilda, which is a beautiful and poignant song. So could you set this up for us, for our mostly Americans, but white people all around the world will be listening to this show recorded later on. It's a beautiful song. What's the background? It's not really talking about the Eureka Rebellion, but it's connected to rebellion and a certain Australian spirit.
There was a following revolt. We've had a whole series of revolts. This was a revolt in 1891. There was a world recession, and prices for wool, which was our major export at that time, before they discovered the minerals, and the price dropped. So the farmers forced the shearers' wages down, and the shearers resisted, and the farmers locked them out. So to get back at them, the shearers went around burning down all the stockpiles of wool, and wool, before it's washed, is very flammable. And so the government was called in, the Queensland government, we were an independent state at that time, and they called in the Queensland Army, all 800 members, and they brought their machine guns and all sorts of paraphernalia.
I see. So in other words, just like the United States was originally 13 different British colonies, and Canada was also different British provinces. There was no Canada back then, there was no United States back then, and there was no Australia. It was different Royal British colonies.
That's right.
So Queensland was a separate British province.
It was a separate state, yeah. Okay. It gained its independence in 1859 from the mother colony, which was New South Wales, based in Sydney. I think everyone's heard of Sydney. It's the largest city in Australia. Brisbane is the capital, or Brisbane, I think you call it, is the capital of Queensland, and we had very few people there. But once we gained independence in 1859, we got our own immigration policy. We started shipping in Germans by the thousands from Pomerania and Silesia, because there was this big fear at that time that the Pope was going to take over Australia. They said, there's too many dang Irishmen here. We've got to counterbalance them. So they brought in all these German Protestants. And one of the upshots was...
And they were hard workers and good people.
They were hard workers, yeah. But the shearers tended to be Irish. And the government was Protestant. And so when they had trouble with the shearers, they thought, it's the Pope at work. So they brought in the army, and this was the 1891 revolt. And it was put down. Hundreds were put on trial once again for sedition, and a lot of them got 3 years hard labor.
Oh, boy.
But 2 years later, as a result of this repression of the shearers union, the Labor Party was formed, and Queensland elected the first socialist party government in the world. It only lasted 6 months, but it makes that landmark. I mean, I think they had a... It wasn't until 1927 they got the Labour Party in Britain, so we beat them by a long haul. But 2 years after, to commemorate this victory of the Labour Party in the elections, they sent a reporter from a man called Banjo Patterson. He was a poet and a reporter.
He's an Australian.
Yeah.
His name was Banjo Patterson.
Yeah. because he used to make up songs and poems.
Oh, really?
As well as being a journalist. He was multi-skilled. And the Bulletin newspaper, our most widely read newspaper, they sent him to Barcaldine, where the revolt had been, and they said, write us a poem that will commemorate this revolt, which led to the formation of the Labour Party government. So he did. He found that at a local billabong, which is a cut-off creek.
Well, we have bongs in America, but I think it's a very different thing. This is a billabong.
Yes, our creeks tend to meander, and they change direction, and the cut-off area becomes just a pond, I think you'd call it, but we call them billabong. It's a local Aborigine word.
Okay.
And so this local shearer.
Well, you see now, you see, so it just shows we can never be racist. So the Australians invented the pond.
Well,
and they called it the billabong.
Yes.
This is why, you see, my hat is off to the Aborigines. Among the other high technologies they have been.
I wouldn't have said that, but there you go.
Well, I can say it because we have freedom of speech in America.
We don't. So I'll leave it to you. But this man years earlier dumped into a local pond, and Banjo said, "Oh, that's very interesting." And then, so he wove that into the story of the revolt very subtly. So what he has is a man who's depressed and down on his luck, who jumps in a pond and drowns himself. But he brings in the character of the cocky, which is a cocky and his thoroughbred, which is the owner of the sheep.
The cocky is a title or a occupation.
It's a term they use. A cow cocky is a name for an owner of a cattle station. I think you call it
like a rancher.
A rancher, very
okay.
True. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
We tend to have we call sheep properties.
Properties.
And you have cattle stations. Now, I think one of the largest cattle stations in Australia is 1 million square miles. Yeah, they have their own airports and shops and everything.
Wow,
there.
Wow.
But
so we would call a rancher or a cattle baron, you would call a cocky.
Cow cocky, yeah.
A cow cocky.
Yeah.
So he's probably, does he have a cocky personality too?
Well, no, another term for them too is squatters.
Squatter.
At one stage the land was just, there was no one there.
Mm-hmm.
And the government allowed anyone who could turn up just to seize land and actually squat on the land. We have a peculiar situation in Australia where the government owns all the land.
Mm-hmm.
If you buy a house, you don't own the land.
Mm-hmm.
You don't own the mineral rights. They can kick you off anytime they like. They can actually sell the mineral rights under your house to a mining corporation, and they'll kick you off. Mm-hmm. And the government will just turn up and say, we're resuming your land, give you a letter, and out you go. And
you know, this is there's so many things I want to say to our listeners. There are so many reasons why we can appreciate the founding fathers of the United States and of our Constitution, because you can see unbelievably tyrannical actions by the Australian government, which is ruled still indirectly by the British government, which is ruled by the Rothschild-dominated Bank of England. And stuff happens in Australia that makes me speechless as an American. As bad as things are in America, the things you described still could not happen here at all. Like you can't own land at all. The government owns the whole country. I mean, in America, you certainly can own land as well as your home. And nobody can throw you off your land except, you know, sometimes long years of court battles. And you're paid and paid well, like if they have to build a highway or something else like that. Well, let's switch gears here for just a second. Now, do you want to say any more about this song, Waltzing Matilda?
Just a final wrap up. The word you'll hear is, here comes the cocky on his thoroughbred, here come the troopers, 1, 2, 3. Now, the troopers, of course, is the Queensland Army. And the reason why they confront the shearer...
And they were redcoats. Did they wear red uniforms, British Army red?
No. The British Army was withdrawn in 1870, and the local state took over. Paramilitary troops, I think. The same people who hunted down Ned Kelly always carried multiple pistols and long arms and the rest of it. So it's always been... if you compare them to the South African frontier troops, commandos, things like that. So we've never really had an idea of sheriffs or anything like that. We've always had a state police force which operates within the entire state. And we have no local police, as you have sheriffs and marshals and things like that. Our police can be transferred anywhere within a state. And the idea is not to have local police administering the local people. And that way they're more likely to be better servants of the state.
Yeah, they'll crack down on them and without sympathy.
Exactly, yeah. So, we don't have this idea of a local sheriff or anything like that. And our police and judges, none of them are elected. They're all appointed.
Oh.
We don't have any sort of direct democracy. The result is that in Australia, we now have the one party, the Labor Party, rules all six states, both federal territories, the federal government itself, and every single major capital city and every industrial city.
It's a one-party government.
One-party state, all three levels. And there's only one city in Brisbane is ruled by an opposition party.
Unbelievable.
But it's a democracy. And people say to me, oh, but is this a democracy? And I said, well, let's not forget, the Soviet Union had elections every 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to choose between a communist and a communist.
Mm-hmm.
So they had a choice, too.
Yeah.
You know, it does. Just because you get to put a piece of paper in a box every 3 years does not make a democracy.
Oh, that is incredible. There's so many more things that we're going to be hearing from our comrade Steve Godfrey. What I'm going to do now is we're going to play this song, Waltzing Matilda. And let's see, I'm setting it up right now. When was is this sort of like the unofficial national anthem of Australia?
It's very much recognized as the official, unofficial. They play it at sports meets, they play it at the Olympics. People can't quite understand the context anymore, but it's because up until 1973, when Whitlam and the Labor Party changed the official national anthem from God Save the Queen, which, as you know, is the English national anthem. Mm-hmm. Until 1973, that was the Australian anthem as well. They adopted Advance Australia Fair, but they found, after they'd adopted it, the two of the four paragraphs are actually racist, because they mention white men from Albion and Cook being a white man and things like that. So two of the verses are never sung. So most Australians only ever know the first line of the first verse. Australia's sons, let us rejoice, for we are young and free. And that's about all of them know.
I see, I see.
Because the rest of it's too racist. It's never sung.
Oh, boy. Well, it's political correctness.
Mm.
Very interesting, very interesting. Well, I'm trying to... something seems to be happening here with... I can't find the button right now to click on to start this song. We haven't done a radio show actually in a while here. Let's see. Maybe I'll ask our sound engineer to play Waltzing Matilda right now. If he can do that, because the button seems to have disappeared for me to start the show myself. Let's see if he can be doing that for us.
Okay, I'll give you a bit more fill-in too.
Okay, great.
Because we've had this, the Labor government under Whitlam only lasted for 3 years, but they brought in a lot of radical changes. They introduced the metric system.
Once a jolly swagman camped by the billabong, under the shade of a coolabah tree. He sang as he sat, he waited while the spilling oil. Come a waltzing Matilda with me. Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda. Drink up at the waterhole. Up jumps the swagman and grabs him with glee. And he said as he put the jam buck in his tucker bag, "You'll come a waltzing Matilda with me. Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda. You'll come a waltzing Matilda with me." And he sang as he sat and waited by the billabong.
With me, and he said,
Thank you very much, Mike, our always helpful and industrious sound engineer for getting that on the air for us. That is a sublime, beautiful, poignant song.
True. You can see the subtlety, too, the way he's woven two unconnected events, the death of a lonely shearer years beforehand who was out
a
of
sheep,
line.
A sheep shearer for
sheep
wool,
shearer,
cutting the wool.
To this uprising. So when people sing it, they're actually commemorating the uprising of 1891. And in those days, because the British banned all songs about convicts or about bush rangers, there's a famous song, The Wild Colonial Boy, and you could be jailed for singing it. And that was up until the 1890s. And Ned Kelly was an Irish convict. His parents were both Irish convicts, and as such, they were the underclass. And as a son of a convict, he couldn't go in any gainful employment, and he was persecuted by the police.
As the son of a convict?
Yes. They were called, children of convicts were called currency kids. We're not quite sure what the terminology meant, but what the British had done was they brought in this class of white slaves, and they were served 7 to 14 years hard labor, mm-hmm. free labor, for the British middle class who then came in to rule the country. So you had a hierarchical system already. And when they were released from bondage and they were only allowed to marry other convicts. And when they were transported for life.
This is unbelievable. Everything I believe you, but this is unbelievable.
Well, they were banished for life from England. They could never return on pain of death. And Dickens has
Well, they committed crimes like stealing bread to eat.
Yes, yes. Well, funny things happened, though. Our first government printer was a man who was transported forging notes. But they were short of printers in the colony, so they gave him a furlough and made him the government printer. And we had all sorts of people got transported, for people who'd stolen from employers and things like that. So we ended up with a whole class of people, but they were banished from England. They could never return on pain of death, and they were stuck here. And the British brought out a ruling class to put over them. And so there was a permanent state of revolt between this Irish, mainly Irish lower class, and this upper middle class British. And the British actually sent out a third group. They called them remittance men. They were usually the third son of a lord or something who'd blotted his copybook in some way and had been kicked out of the family home. And these people used to wander the countryside. So it's always been a place for outcasts and criminals. And you imagine that America, if it had, instead of 300 million people, only 20 million people, we have the lowest population density in the world. There's only one person in Australia for every 4 square kilometres. So you can go for days without seeing anybody. It's a beautiful place. But that's the basis for the song, that there's this class oppression even in Australia, and the only release you've got is to commit suicide.
That's what
the fella did.
Oh, my goodness. It's a poignant song. I'd like to have the alternation of the male voice and the female voice. Her voice is very clear. As an American, I was having a little bit of a hard time understanding some of the words. Now, what is a swagman?
There's been a lot of research done on that. They still have swagmen in Germany, apparently. In the old days, you had a system where you had an apprentice, a journeyman, and a master. Now, the only way you learn to trade, say you want to be a carpenter, you'd go to a master and be his apprentice. After a couple of years, he'd say, okay, you're good enough, I'll give you your ticket, go off and work for someone else. And he'd work for a series of masters as a journeyman.
Journeyman.
And in Germany, they still do this, and they wander the countryside until they're ready to sit for their master's exam. They think they've learned from enough masters. And one thing they do is they carry a swag, or what we call humping the bluey, because you wrap up all your belongings in a canvas bag and then strap it to your back. And apparently they still do this in parts of Germany. So the Waltzing the Matilda is a corruption of an original German term, because there are a lot of Germans who come to Australia in the 1870s, and they brought this idea of apprentice, journeyman, master with them.
So Matilda's not a woman, then?
No, he's talking about his swaggy, because, well, if you want to take it literally...
He's got a little pole with a bag on it with his belongings in
it. Yes, but if you want to take it literally, it's his only companion. So he's something he sleeps on. So you can read certain meanings into it if you like. And of course, the shearer's life was very lonely. They had to walk everywhere, and you could have stations that were hundreds of miles apart. And the shearers used to walk either individually or one at a time. And so their only companion was a dog and this Matilda. So
Very interesting. Yeah. Well, you know, I think Americans periodically have had their sort of love affair with Australia reinforced. I think the two most famous Australians were Crocodile Dundee, a fictitious character, played by the actor Paul Hogan. And so I remember one scene from this movie. It just showed, like, the Australians were two-fisted fighters and drinkers. And we Americans like that because we have a lot of that Celtic spirit of rebellion, and we all think we're freedom fighters. So he is he's in New York City, and I guess a black and a Puerto Rican or something, they confront him, and he give me your money. And he says, why? Because we've got a knife, you know. And he says, knife? You call that a knife? And he pulls out this gigantic machete. It was the best moment in the whole movie.
It's funny because every American who remembers that movie only remembers that scene, whereas for Australians, to us, that's, oh yeah, you know, that's the scene in America, because we like the movie up until it gets to America. Mm. And it's a sort of, I don't know if you've seen the movies, things like John Doe Goes to Washington, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, things like the idea of Gary Cooper, Jimmy Stewart, an innocent in the big city. Mm-hmm. And so that movie was made in that sort of context. But the scenes that we like, the one in Australia where Linda Kozlowski, who plays this New York, you know, hard-boiled journalist, he's driving down a track in the outback in a four-wheel drive, and there's a water buffalo. We have millions of water buffalo. They're brought over during the colonial times and released, and they're just everywhere. And the water buffalo is confronting the vehicle, and rather than charge it, he gets out and he puts a hex on it. And he eyes it out, and he puts it to sleep. And she gets the camera and goes, oh, my God, oh, my God. And he makes nothing of it. And the subtlety of the humor, we think, oh, that is so funny. It's just the subtlety rather than, you know, confronting power and things like that. Another scene, too, where he goes to the water hole and he's laying out all these traditional foods, and he says, now, here's witchetty grubs, and here's this, and here's this, and here's all the traditional foods I want you to eat. And she said, oh, okay, and what are you going to eat? He said, I'm going to have me bacon and eggs over here. Do you think I'm stupid? And just this, we've got the Australian sense of humour is essentially Irish, and that it's a reverse humour in which we have what we call a tall puppy syndrome. If someone gets too big for their britches, we pull them down. And so there's no real hierarchy in Australia. Everybody's equal.
I read once that in Australia, it's good form when you hail a cab, you get in the front seat next to the cab driver.
Always.
Only a snob would sit in back.
Yeah, we can't understand. Although I was reading an interview with a Filipino diplomat recently, and he said he was so insulted that the cab driver insisted he get in the front seat. Oh, that's only a place for servants. So I made sure when I got out, I punched him in the face. And we thought, oh, my God. And that's we have this real problem with foreigners coming to the country, and they don't understand. Sitting in the back says you're above somebody.
Mm-hmm.
You sit in the front, and you talk to the driver and say, how's your day been? And he says, oh, how's your been? And you have a chat.
Egalitarian spirit.
We have an egalitarian system because it is every day enforced by everybody, and anyone who tries to buck it is in trouble.
Mm.
And it's not like we don't have to pass a law saying everybody's equal. Everybody makes sure everybody's equal.
To hold you down if you get too big for your britches.
Yeah, and it's what they call the tall puppy syndrome. So
tall
puppy. Anyone who gets too big for the britches, they get cut off at the knees.
Very interesting. Very well, you know, of course, our population mix is a little different. Our biggest group in the United States, and I publish this a lot on my website at johndenugent.com and other places, the biggest group in the United States is actually Germans, about 60 million, almost the same as the population of Germany. And so you have an element of respect for authority, discipline, hard work, and up and down this road here, Ekestown Road, everybody's German and Slovak. Every lawn is cut with manicure scissors. Your neighbors are never nosy. They're respectful, keep their distance, very, very honest. Here in Pennsylvania, the car inspection, it took me 2 weeks to get my used car inspectable. 45-minute inspection. They dismantle your car, pull off all the wheels, check all the systems. I had to drive an hour and 20 minutes to get a seatbelt for my used car, an hour and 20 minutes back, and it's just 2 weeks to get this car up to snuff, to get the car perfect. Even rust will disqualify your car. So we've got this German element. We have an English people also, who are authority and discipline and whatnot, and we have Scandinavians and Dutch. But we also have the other side of a big side of America is we have Eastern Europeans, particularly here in this four-state region that I was mentioning, Poles and Slovaks and Ukrainians and Russians. And these, they're not technically Slavs, but you have Hungarians and Czechs and all kinds of Eastern European people, which are another branch of our wonderful white race. And there are people who are patient. They can take a lot of suffering. They're fantastic workers in coal mines and in steel mills. They're just tough and uncomplaining people. And many of them are very, very good people, too. And whereas there was a problem with alcoholism in Eastern Europe because of the oppression, I don't see that in America, because in America you can make it. You don't have to hit the bottle because you're depressed, because there are plenty of Polish Americans and Ukrainian Americans who've risen to the middle class and done great. I see them up and down our road here. So we have the Germanic element in America, which is serious and hardworking and reserved, and we have the Slavic people, and then we have, I believe, actually the strongest element is the one that is akin to yours, which is the Celts. In fact, the Barnes Review has an excellent article about the role of the Scots in the American Revolution. The Scots, to a man, and to a woman, and to a child, and the Scots dog, fought for the American Revolution to get the British ruling class out. The Scotch-Irish also fought them. The Irish, of course, there were Irishmen in the Boston Massacre and the Boston Tea Party, and, you know, all the world's troubles, or troubles that need to be fought against an Irishman, will open his mouth. And they've got that fiery, impulsive spirit. I'm not going to think about it 10 times. I'm going to act now because I feel like acting right now. And I have to say, this is one thing I do admire about black people, is black people just haul off and sock you in the mouth if they feel you deserve it. And maybe they'll get in trouble, maybe they'll go to jail. But sometimes it's good to be impulsive and act on your instincts and not think, well, I better consult my lawyer first before I do what my body and my soul and my heart are screaming for me to do right now. So I think the Celts are a very important part of Australia, and they're a very important part of American history as well. In fact, George Washington said if the British were to beat him along up and down the Atlantic coastline along the seaboard there, he would retreat to the Appalachian Mountains, and he would fight with his Scots and with the Scotch-Irish and with his Irishmen up in the hills, until the British finally got there. He would wear them down until they left. And it was a 7 years war. Hey, the British are tough and admirable fighters. But eventually they just said, we're never going to win this thing. The whole countryside's against us, you know, and let's just cut a deal and get out.
Did you want to ask any questions about Cronulla or Pauline Hanson or anything like that?
Well, you know, I'm enjoying our interview so much. What I'd like to do is start talking with you a little bit about what's happening to Australia and about freedom of speech and politics in Australia. You're touring the United States right now, so what I'd like to do is have you back on for talk for the next 15 minutes or so that we have left, and perhaps we could even do another show and talk more extensively about conditions. Frankly, I was thunderstruck at the things you told me last night as we walked through beautiful nighttime Pittsburgh. The lack of freedom of speech. The thing which struck me the most was that you said that in the wake of 9/11, the Australian government passed all kinds of emergency secret police laws, and one is that the secret police can scoop you up for 7 days, and it's a felony at once you're released with no charges. You can't call a lawyer, can't call your family, and you can't even tell people that you were arrested.
That's true. Yes. It's one of the strange features of the Act that if a reporter finds out you've been arrested, he's not allowed to report it, or he can be arrested for reporting it. And they raise these strange questions that your wife asks, where have you been for the last 7 days? You're not allowed to tell her, or she can be arrested and you can be rearrested. Because it's, I think the aim of they passed 20 ASIO laws, they call them. We have our version of the FBI is what they call the Australian Security Intelligence Organization. Now, it's the nature of our federation. It varies from the American system, and it's why we think that we're able to re-separate. I think you still had that idea up until 1860. It was knocked out of you. But when our federal government passes a law, it doesn't become law until each individual state passes what they call an enabling act. So the federal
Canada has that also.
Yeah. So that way the federal government doesn't actually rule, the states rule, and the federation is supposed to rule on behalf of the states. So that's why each state in Australia, we have a governor general who rules on behalf of the Queen, but each state has a state governor who rules on behalf of the Queen too.
The Queen, you're referring to a gay Australian?
No, the Queen of England is the Queen of Australia.
Is the Queen of Australia?
Yeah, she's our official monarch. And that's why when the state owns the land, they don't say the state, they say it's Crown Land.
Crown Land.
The Queen of England owns the whole of Australia. And so when they take your land off you and say they're going to give it to the Aborigines, as happened to 17 station owners or property owners, ranchers up in Cape York, they took their properties away. They had 99-year leases, and the government just dissolved the leases. And then they said, we're now going to make these national parks because they just passed Aboriginal land rights legislation, which interestingly said any national park could now be claimed as Aboriginal land. So now they've all passed from being productive farmland to being complete wasteland. And that's happened to a huge swatch. If anyone gets a current map of Australia, you'll see there's a brown streak running from around about Darwin down to the Australian Bight in South Australia.
Oh, the Bight is an old word for bay, I believe.
It's enormous. It's about 1,000 miles wide.
Oh, it's a big bay.
Yeah.
A bight.
So this brown
streak. B-I-G-H-T.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah, a bight.
It's a... You don't use that term here. No.
Well, it's just an old word. In German, you still have the word bucht. It's an old Germanic word. It's a gigantic bay, I guess.
Because I know there's a place off Germany called Heligoland Bay that had a famous battle there.
B-U-C-H-T in German, bucht.
Yeah, Heligoland Bight.
Yeah.
But this brown streak, if you look at any new map of Australia, you'll see it's a patchwork of Aboriginal land claims, and it actually severs the country in half. Western Australia on one side, and the eastern states and the other, but Northern Territory and South Australia are nearly all Aboriginal land claims. What they've done recently, a year ago they claimed the entire city of Perth, and they were given it. A year ago they claimed the city of Broome in Northern Western Australia.
The Aborigines own the entire huge city of Perth?
They're trying to work out the details now. They own all of Alice Springs.
Well, actually, here's my proposition. Now, we have pretty much absolute freedom of speech in America. I propose we give Perth back to the Aborigines. What we do is we take a big carpet, and we roll up all the skyscrapers and all the superhighways and all the high-tech universities and the beach umbrellas, and we take all the high-tech, we rip it up, roll it into a carpet, put it under your arm, and walk back to Sydney with it, and return it to the Aborigines in its pristine original condition.
That has been suggested. They've been demanding an apology from our government for years. And, of course, an apology implies a legal obligation and implies compensation.
Right.
So the last government refused for 12 years to give them an apology. The first thing the Labor did when they got elected in December 07 was to issue them an apology. And the next day came the bill for compensation. And they're demanding billions and billions of compensation. But no, this someone put out on the internet an Australian apology, and he says, "I'm sorry we built roads. I'm sorry we built schools. I'm sorry we put clothes on your back and made you wear pants. I'm sorry we stopped you killing each other and practicing cannibalism." And it's just sorry. We're really.
Yeah. It reminds me of Monty Python. Do you ever see? You know, there was a Monty Python. It was The Life of Brian, I think, or something. It was a spoof. The Ministry of Jesus. So the Monty Python boys are playing rebellious Jews, and they say, and one of them says, "What's the Roman Empire ever done for us?" The other one says, "Yeah, besides aqueducts and law and order and roads and cities and civilizations, nothing."
That's my wife's favorite scene. She's always saying to me, every time we complain about the government, she says, "Yeah, but what about the aqueducts?" Like, okay. But no, that's the problem we have with the Aborigines are a special category. They were mentioned by Darwin when he did his tour of the globe in 1854 on the Beagle. He was gathering evidence for his theory of evolution. He stopped in Australia.
The Beagle, he floated on a Beagle to...
No, yes, you're Snoopy. No.
The Beagle was the name of his HMS. Was it a U.S. Was it a Royal Navy warship? Or?
Yeah, Discovery. When Cook came to Australia as a British Navy, they sent a lot of exploration. British did a lot of exploration, a lot of mapping, survey things.
Well, that's part of the white race, is the Northern European peoples love to discover. Did you know, you told me there's a lot of American TV in Australia. Do you still have the series Star Trek?
Oh, thank goodness, no.
But anyway, Star Trek started off where Captain Kirk says the four-year mission of the Starship Enterprise is to boldly go where no man has gone before. That's such a Nordic, Northern European thing, to explore the world bravely, curiously, creatively, let's find out what's on the other side of the horizon.
And I know that they did a, Paul Hogan had a comedy show before he got into Crocodile Dundee, he's the star of Crocodile Dundee, and he did that. He dressed up as Captain Kirk, and they said, boldly go where no man has gone before. And he looks both ways, and he ducks into the women's toilet. But that's the Australian sense of humor. They tend to take the stuffing out of everything. So it's,
deflate the pomposity.
No, my wife is a Star Trek fan, and I'd never watched it before I met her. And we're now on series 10 of Stargate, which is Babylon 5. And the last time I watched Star Trek, the official series, though, they had a woman commander, and I sort of gave up on it after.
Well, there was a rule. The Jews were completely taken over that series. There was a rule on all the later Star Treks that nobody can marry somebody of the same species. The Klingon is married to a Romulan, and the white is married to a lizard woman.
Well, you know the black woman who played the radio operator, I think.
Lieutenant Uhuru.
Uhuru. She was in one of these documentaries they made. She said, it was a token role, and she was going to quit. And she was rung up by Martin Luther King and told, no, you're a role model for black women. So she stayed on the show. And she claims that they had the first interracial kiss in 1964 when she kissed Captain Kirk in an episode.
So 65 or 66, probably, yeah.
So that's... See, we don't have that idea of, I'm doing this as a role model for... But one thing I've noticed, I've got to point out something here. I've traveled from Reno, Nevada, down California, New Mexico, Arizona, then through Texas, all the way down to the bottom and back up again. Now, down that side, where you seem to have a lot of Mexicans, every major city has a Cesar Chavez Avenue. But when I hit Texas and started heading back up here, every major city has a Martin Luther King Avenue.
Mm-hmm. It's usually a combat zone, too. It's just gunfire and bullets flying.
Well, the puzzle to me is...
It's the rough section of town. It's the black section. It's always in the black section.
Well, it struck me when I got as far north as here, I suddenly thought, well, what was the previous name of that avenue? Who has been erased from history? And I know that you're dropping a lot of Robert E. Lee schools and things. We're doing the same thing in Australia. They're rolling back. The Victorian government, Labor government, were about to be thrown out a couple of years back, and the last act they did in the last week of power was they erased 300 white names from the map and replaced them with Aborigine names. Now, you're probably familiar with South Africa, where they changed the name of Pretoria to Tshwane, something like that.
Yeah.
And they want to rename Sydney as some other silly thing. Names mean ownership.
It's the guilt trip they're foisting on whites,
yes,
especially on white males. But all whites should apologize, get down on their knees, say, I am so sorry. What can I do for you to make up for bringing you technology and freedom and law and order and wealth and food in your stomach?
Well, what puzzles me, you know, in Rhodesia, I mean, Rhodes didn't walk in and say, this is Zimbabwe, you know, I want to come here and assimilate. And he said, this is Rhodes Land or Rhodesia. Like Queensland is named after Queen Victoria, and the state is named after Victoria. Mm-hmm. We named the land, and I really honestly think the big mistake made, this is my personal opinion, but when the land was conquered off the Mexicans after 1848, you really should have stamped it.
Change the names.
Yeah, I mean, San Antonio, Santa Barbara, San Jose, San Francisco, I mean, who do you think is going to claim ownership of those?
It's called St. Anthony. Called the Saint.
That's right.
And Los Angeles call it City of Angels, but there are just so few angels in Los Angeles.
So it's only natural now you see Mexicans there, and they're speaking Mexican to each other. And all down that strip, California, New Mexico, Arizona, every place you go to, they've got multilingual signs. The buses are multilingual. Everybody has to speak Mexican. Even the Negroes you find are speaking Mexican because all the staff they work with, all the customers are Mexican. So it wasn't until I got to Washington, D.C., I saw my first large groups of white people, and I...
You got to come back here to this white bastion where we're creating the Salutrian tribe here. Butler County is 98% white, and we've got to go for a little walk here, Steve, and just see the beauty of this area. How much longer will you be in the United Snakes?
I'd rather not say, but I've got to be back in Australia in early December.
Early December, okay.
People have said to me that they didn't know I was coming to America, and I said, I'm keeping you very low-key. It's hard to get out of Australia. Anyone who's followed the Tobin case in London knows what I mean.
Yes.
They let you out, and then they trap you on the way. So it's best not to be specific.
I see. Well, what we would like to do is have you come back and talk hard politics, what's going on, freedom of speech issues, so that Americans can be warned and mentally armed to understand what the New World Order would like to do here in America unless we resist with these two bulging biceps that we have. One is the First Amendment, absolute right to gather and speak, freedom of religion, freedom of the press, and the other giant biceps that we have for American freedom is the freedom to own guns. And these are sacred. America was based on freedom from the beginning, and we fought. The British did not grant us independence. We ripped it from them by force of arm, and we killed them until they left. And because we had to, even though they were our blood brothers, and you know, the average white Englishman was a fine young lad. Often he was forced into the military, didn't want to be here shooting at his white brothers. But what I'd like to do is ask our sound engineer to play Waltzing Matilda as we end today's show. And I want to thank you very much, white brother Steve Godfrey from Australia. Thank you for coming to America and speaking around the United States, telling us things. We love your Australian sense of humor. We appreciate your bravery. When we have you on again, I'd like to find out more about the persecution, what you've been through, standing up for white rights. And I'm sure it'll be very inspiring to us. So if our sound engineer can put on Waltzing Matilda again, then we will we'll have that to end our show. So you're heading off to the Midwest next, Steve? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I'm trying to keep it non-specific.
Sure, I understand.
Accidents tend to happen to people in my line of work.
I understand that. You said something absolutely chilling about how a strange man came up to you and shook your hand, and right after that, suddenly, in the peak of health, you had a heart attack, and you said some stuff that was really alarming about the ability to transmit a chemical which will cause a person to fall extremely ill. And apparently they've got an immunity on their skin, but they're passing it on to you. And at 46, you look to be in fine shape. It was a year ago you suddenly had a violent heart attack.
Mm.
It was out of the blue.
Well, it's the pills that are keeping me alive, but I was in intensive care for 9 days. And, you know, it's one of those miracles. But, yeah, it's the system, you know. As people say, they use various ways of getting rid of you. If they can't shut you up, they sack you from your job, they take your wife away, they take your kids away, they take your credibility away, they take your house away. Finally, they take your life.
Right. Well, you are, we salute you, you and your bravery. And our sound engineer is going to play to us now, again, this beautiful song, Waltzing Matilda, about an apprenticeship. A man walking with his Matilda is basically his bag of his belongings. He's a working class Australian white man.
And the jumbuck is a sheep.
And the jumbuck is a sheep. Oh, of course, we knew that.
Small one, the little one.
And the swag man and the billabong. And we're learning about this other great branch of our civilization. All right. So and then we'll play Waltzing Matilda. Now, can you come back on our show?
I'd be happy to at the earliest opportunity.
Wonderful. Then that's what we'll do. All right. then what we'll do is we'll have Waltzing Matilda come on and we'll end our show. Thank you very much for listening to the John DeNugent Show from blogtalkradio.com and sponsored by...
A jolly swag man camped by the billabong, under the shade of a coolabah tree. He sang as he sat, he waited while the city boy come a waltzing Matilda with me. Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, who come a waltzing.
comes a squatter, riding on a thoroughbred. Up steps a trooper, one, two, three. Where's the jolly jamba? Who got in your tucker bag? Jumped into the water hole, drowning himself by the coolabah tree, and his ghost may be heard.